For those who believe in climate change, and many believe it is now a climate crisis, action must be taken immediately. Because our future, we are told, is now at a tipping point. But what actions should be taken, and how do we know they're not going to cause any harm? Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak, and thanks for being part of our program today. And if you'd like to be part of the discussion today, just send us an email. Drop it to us now. We're at tfs@wshu.org, or you can find us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. You may know this. The news came down the other week that New York State now has one of the most ambitious climate change laws in the country. And proponents are hoping that it serves as a model for the rest of the country. Now, after we talked about the plan the other week, which calls for a number of wind farms off of Long Island in the Atlantic, we received a number of emails from some who are concerned that all variables and ramifications are not being considered as plans are made for our future. Near the top of the list, at least in terms of wind farms, are the potential effects on the fishing industry and marine life. On our program the other week, we spoke with Bonnie Brady. Bonnie has been our guest before. She's the executive director of the Long Island Fishing Association, and this is what she had to say.
If we're really talking about shaving peak and shaving use, we should be conserving first. That should be first and foremost. When you put the windmills out there, they have consequences to them where you don't want to destroy the environment that you're supposed to be saving. There's a study from Harvard that says that using wind will actually make the planet warmer, and that the carbon footprint of being able to create this stuff, which includes thousands and thousands of tons of steel and fiberglass and rare earth minerals, and everything else, and there's 4,000 gallons of hydraulic fluids and synthetic oils in each turbine, and the electric service platforms have 70,000 gallons. So for the example, for the Vineyard Wind site, you're talking about 700,000 gallons of oils and hydraulic fluids and greases in one of the 12 miles south of one of the most pristine areas known to man in Nantucket. You don't necessarily, it's almost a law of unintended consequences. We need to look at this holistically, but the way to solve it is not to destroy something else. That's what I truly believe.
Two guests are joining us now to talk about this. Professor R. Lawrence Swanson is an associate dean at the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences and director of Waste Reduction and Management Institute at Stony Brook University. Professor Swanson is the chair of the Suffolk County Council on Environmental Quality and is a member of the Governor's Ocean Acidification Task Force. And I mentioned we received a number of emails after our last show. One of them came from David Michel. David grew up in France, is now a Connecticut state representative from Stamford, and he's a member of the legislature's Environment Committee, and he's in the studio with me. Professor David, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David, I'm going to spend a few minutes with the professor, and then you and I are going to be able to chat right after that, so we'll get to you in just a moment. Professor, when you look at the wind farms, do you have any concerns?
Sure. I think some of the issues that were raised with regard to impacts on fishing are certainly something that one needs to look into. However, the consequences of not investing in wind farms and perhaps solar is an impact on the fishing industry as well, in that we're already seeing changes in distributions of fishery stocks as a consequence of increasing temperatures in the ocean. We're seeing changes as a consequence of ocean acidification with regard to the shell fishing industry. So not doing anything is not going to particularly help the fishing industry either. So I think we need to be bold, step out, do what we can, and improve the business and industry of solar and wind as we move forward.
Professor, it sounds from what you're saying very similar to what one of our guests on the last program said. She was a representative of the Audubon Society, and basically they had looked at some of the issues regarding wind turbines and birds. But her point sounds very similar to yours in that she was saying, yeah, we have to make a choice here, because if we don't get clean, renewable energy, there may not be any birds. I'm paraphrasing her, but that was the gist of it.
I think she's absolutely right, and certainly just in this last week, I think many of the notions about the warming planet have been reinforced with some of the pictures and so forth that we've seen from the melting ice in Greenland. So things are happening now. They're happening very rapidly, and if we don't do anything, our problems with the oceans and the environment in general are only going to get worse. We can't sit on our hands and do nothing.
Now, I know that part of our program today, we're talking about changing our habits. We're putting up the wind farms. We're having the solar fields installed, which are all good. And you know, we're driving, hopefully going to have electric cars and so on. But we really do have to change. I mean, we're talking about a sea change of habits, aren't we?
Yes. And I think one of the most important changes that we could make is to put much greater investment in public transportation. We should not be relying on the automobile, even if it's electric, to the extent that we do.
So you're saying more of us should be taking buses, trolleys, trains?
Right, and I think our political leaders need to step up to the plate and say, we're going to invest in improving our railroads and improving our buses and so that it's comfortable and pleasant, and we want to take public transportation rather than getting in our automobiles and driving all the time.
Now, Professor, I think you and I could probably spend an hour. Maybe we'll do that sometime in the future, just you and I talking about how are we going to change our habits. I mean, because you're talking about what we're doing this year being, if 5 years from now, we all may have a completely different way of life.
I think that's absolutely correct, and it's going to show in many different ways how we drive or we don't drive, how we get our energy. All those things, I think, are absolutely important, and we need to be willing to make changes and not just live with status quo.
So just to clarify, when you see the wind farms, when you see the proposals, when you see what they're proposing for the future in terms of expansion of wind farms, you're in favor of that?
I am. And I must say that probably 10 years ago, I was a skeptic. I think it's clear that we need to do something, and wind farms are proving to be more efficient and more effective than they were a decade or so ago. And this is a positive way forward.
Just out of curiosity, why were you a skeptic?
I was particularly concerned with what would happen off the south shore of Long Island and with regard to the redistribution of sediment, with the impact on the fishing industry and so forth. But I think I now understand that those consequences are relatively small compared to what we're seeing with the overall change in global atmospheric temperatures and global ocean temperatures. And it's not worth the risk of completely changing our planet so it becomes less and less habitable as we know it. We need to move forward promptly and boldly.
Professor, a number of months back, we did a program which I kind of tongue-in-cheek entitled Green versus Green. And one of my listeners got upset at me and they said, it's not really that. It's more shades of green, if you will, nowadays, choosing which is the best path to take.
Well, I think that's right. But those are we've always had to make those kind of choices, right? Everything is not absolute. And we don't always know the answers. We don't always know the consequences. But if we are not willing to make moves and try to advance technology, to try to advance our attitudes and how we use resources, then, you know, we're just going to suffer from a deteriorating globe.
So many of us, as I mentioned before, are set in our habits, and I know we have to break in a moment, and I hope you could stay with us for just a minute or two after the break, because I'd love to talk with you a little bit about really changing our habits. I mean, from everything we do now in our daily lives, because our guest who's sitting across from me when he and I were speaking on the phone the other day, and he was saying, you know, if we do certain things today, maybe we don't have to do these other things. Maybe we don't have to do as many wind turbines or solar panel fields because there are ramifications to that. Professor Lawrence R. Lawrence Swanson is an associate dean at the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences and also the director of Waste Reduction and Management Institute at Stony Brook University. David Michel has been very patient. He's a Connecticut State Representative from Stamford. He's on the Environment Committee up at the legislature. And we would love to hear from you. If you would like to comment on today's program, how about dropping us an email? We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Twitter, you can find us at FullStoryWSHU. And remember, all our shows are available as podcasts. You can take them to the beach with you. You can download the full story on Google Play or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. David Michel is a Connecticut State Representative from Stamford. He serves on the legislature's Environment Committee, one of many committees that he serves on. David, nice to meet you.
Thank you, Ron. Nice to meet you.
It's after our last show, you dropped me an email saying, I listened to the program, I enjoyed it, but, and there was a big but in there, and basically on that program, we were talking about the wind farms, and you were saying, in effect, you know, there are consequences to these wind farms being put up that people really aren't looking at nowadays, or at least the news isn't getting out there.
Yes, so as I started with the legislature, when we started session, I stumbled upon this energy procurement that was already contracted with Ørsted for Connecticut, 200 megawatts, and as well as there was some pending at the time with Rhode Island, but that was already previous from the previous legislation, and it raised concerns to me. I was approached by some people saying, "What do you think about offshore wind?" I said, "I'm all for renewable energy, but we have to do it properly, because if we add other factors that are stressing the environment or hurting or potentially injuring or killing our keystone species, then we'll lose many other species, and it will have an impact on for example, injuring the North Atlantic right whales with noise would endanger also the fisheries." The whales are like gardeners in the sea. They feed on plankton. And their plume that they leave behind is filled with nutrients that feeds phytoplankton. And the phytoplankton is food for the zooplankton, which is the small animal life, we'll call it. So crustaceans, baby crustaceans and fish. And if you don't have healthy marine ecosystems, we're basically risking our whales, then we're risking everything else, including the birds, because mm-hmm. the birds feed on marine life. So that's what we call a keystone species. There's apex species, apex predators, and there's also keystone species like whales and sea turtles.
But, you know, the professor is still with us, and Professor, you can jump in anytime. And I think you heard what he had to say. I'm sorry, he's gone. But you heard what he had to say, which is basically, look, it's gotten so bad right now. We need to do something, and he understands your concerns, but we're at that tipping point.
Well, it's very important to note that the oceans are the climate regulators. They are protecting us from bad climate and potentially worsening climate. By hurting the marine ecosystem, we're also contributing to climate change. The phytoplankton I was mentioning just before is also the same phytoplankton that produces more than 50% of the oxygen in the air we breathe. It's also important to note that the oceans are being hurt by the animal agriculture. Mm. So when you're talking about habits, I was thinking, well, maybe we should talk about what people eat. That's a habit that we need to change. Dead zones. We went from, I believe, under 50 dead zones in the 1960s to more than 400 currently. In the Baltic Sea, it's dead zone. Basically, there's no oxygen on the bottom of the Baltic Sea year-round, which means no life can really thrive there. And so we need to think about those kind of habits as well. There's plastic pollution, there is, but renewable energy, it's really important that we do it right. If we don't do it right, people think sometimes that I'm against it. I'm not against it, I'm in favor of it. But it has to be done in the most precautionary way.
So what's the right way to put up a wind farm?
Well, I mean, so you have three main techniques to install a wind turbine offshore. You have two methods that involve pile driving, which basically you're hammering steel pipes into the seafloor and creating a really...
An anchor, if you will, for the turbine.
Correct. But at the same time, you're creating a lot of noise. Mm. Now, in the plans in the offshore wind development, you can see that they mention migratory routes and feeding and mating waters. These are no longer, they're changing. They're changing with the currents, with the temperature changing. So we can no longer really accurately plan where whales will be at a specific time.
Mm.
So if we really want to protect, and by the way, I'll say the fisheries as well, at least the marine life, we really want to make sure that we're not causing damage to the keystone species from which the rest of the marine life depends on.
So I think I understand what you're saying. So they're planning to put up the wind farms in certain areas based on current data, but in the meantime, with climate change causing so much change in the migratory patterns, how can you plan for that for the future?
So you've got several phases. The two main phases are construction and operational. The construction is where the most noise will be generated. So pile driving, steel pipes. Now there's other techniques, and they're developing more techniques. So you could still use monopiles without making as much noise, but most of them are not currently available. They're in research. You also have concrete gravity base, which is 6,000 tons of concrete that is floated to the area and then silently dropped to the seafloor. Mm. It can be lifted up again. With the steel pipes, there's studies that just came out in the last month or the last couple of months that also criticize the structural integrity with the steel pipes, causing insurance claims.
Structural integrity? You mean coming along with hurricanes or superstorms? You think these could possibly snap?
So it could be structural integrity that is compromised near where the pile driving is being done, where the hammering is done.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of questions. So the developers were advertising the monopiles with a life of 25 years. Now it seems like it's 15 years or maybe even less.
Okay, so with the 3 minutes that we have left, obviously you don't have any impact, you don't have any power for New York State and what they're doing for wind farms, but what can you do in Connecticut that may impact Connecticut's future?
Well, we have a commission that has actually basically just finished all we're done with basically giving our comments to the DEEP, and hopefully the DEEP will generate a proper request for proposal, an RFP, that is coming August 15th. And we need to scrutinize that RFP to make sure that we're doing the most possible precautionary approach to protect the marine life and fisheries.
Are you worried that we're just rushing as fast as we can now to fight climate change and we're not considering?
Yeah, I mean, I was disappointed during session. I was trying to introduce amendments to the bill that would put in that precautionary approach for the whales, for example, which would protect the rest of the marine life. And even some environmental advocacy group were against that and were telling us.
They were.
Yeah, and they were telling us basically legislators to push for which type of base the developer should use. If we do that, then we're setting up ourselves in trouble for the future. What if there's new technology and other bases that are better? So we can't dictate one base, but we can use a precautionary approach.
But just with the minute that we have left before we bring in Wayne Turrett, is this, do you have the time to for this consideration that you're saying? Look, I'm watching the Democratic presidential debate and Jay Inslee comes on and he goes, look, folks, we're at a tipping point. We have to make big changes right now.
We have very clear science about the noise threshold that would injure the North Atlantic right whales, baleen whales. That's the Southall et al. Peer-reviewed study and also the black whale study. The Southall was just updated in 2019. That's the latest science we have. It says in there 168 decibels, a noise threshold, SEL, above 168 decibels, there's normal calling from the whales. You can't hear the whales anymore. They're not communicating with each other anymore.
David Michel, Connecticut State Representative from Stamford, environmentalist. And we are going to bring in now Wayne Turrett. And he is an architect, and he's the founder of the Turrett Collaborative. Wayne, how are you? Thanks for joining us today.
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks for having me on. We appreciate your time, and I hope you don't mind. David's going to sit in this conversation with us as an environmentalist. He's very interested in what you have to say because you've done something that many of us would like to do if we had the time and if we had the capability and the ability. You've built something called a passive house in Greenport. What's a passive house?
So a passive house is a concept. It's a concept of energy conservation. It actually comes from Germany as an energy efficiency standard. It consists of a number of different things. It's orienting in the house in a certain way, to the south mostly, sealing up the envelope so there's no air going in and out of it, and then it's a lot of insulation. And then because it's sealed up like it is, there's a device called an ERV, which actually brings fresh air into the house all the time and exhausts out the stale air while keeping the embodied energy of the air that's going out, so you're not losing a lot of energy. So it's a very energy-efficient house. The amount of heating and air conditioning is very, very low, and it's a standard that's gaining traction.
It sounds wonderful, and the first question that comes to my mind is this expensive to do?
So the interesting thing is that there's other misconceptions, too, like you might have to have small windows or anything like that, but there really are no restrictions. You could have huge windows, you could have a lot of light. It's really a pleasure to live in. Is it more expensive? I'd say no. It's probably a net the same as building a house, maybe a little bit more. The reason I say that is that the cost of the extra insulation is somewhat offset by the less expensive need for air conditioning and heating. Because you're building such an efficient envelope, you can reduce the amount of heating and cooling you need, and so that reduces the overall cost of that, which then you could put into insulation. So in the end, I don't think it really is. If it's 10% more, maybe, it's definitely worth it because you'll be saving all these years from that point on.
It sounds very similar, I think, to what you're saying, to what those who are putting solar panels on their homes are saying, which is, look, you may be paying for it a little bit now, but in the long run, it's going to save you money.
Yeah, and not only that. I mean, it helps save the environment as well, right? You are using less energy. In my house, for instance, I don't have any fossil fuels, although electricity is made with fossil fuel, a lot of it, but every appliance that I have is electric, and so I have no gas, I have no natural gas, and the amount of energy I use is much smaller than a normal house. It's less than half the amount you would need. So you're not only saving money, but you're saving the environment as well.
David, who's still with us, he and I were speaking on the phone the other day, and we were talking about changing habits, right, and looking at things in a different way. This fits right into that. Wayne, many of us live in homes that were built in the 50s, in the 60s. They weren't really designed for efficiency. What can those homeowners do?
So, I mean, there are retrofit details you can do to your home. So, you know, in those homes, there are companies that go around and do an energy, kind of an energy...
Like an audit? Yep.
Yeah, an audit. And they will come in and they will blow in insulation in your walls and things like that. Certainly that helps, but one of the big issues with older homes is thermal bridging, which is essentially that the studs tend to conduct cold and heat through the wall to your inside from the outside. So it's very hard to stop that in an older home unless you really are completely renovating that house. But if you were just living in the house and you didn't want to do a major renovation, I would go with the energy audit. It's better than nothing. You know, and then there's other things you could do possibly, like putting awnings over windows that get too much light in the summer, too much solar gain, so that your cooling is much more much needed. Things like that you can do. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, do you think this is the start of a trend? This is going to be the fashionable thing to do? Because I still see some McMansions being built and, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 square foot homes that two or three people live in. And I always think to myself, I don't get it. I just don't get that. But that's me. Do you think the trend in the future will be for those who are designing homes that are a bit smaller and energy efficient?
Yeah, I think that there is a trend going in that direction, but I also think that there will always be people building crazy homes. But in general, in my field, in sort of my world, I see it gaining more and more speed. I think that there are more and more architects becoming aware of this. But again, you know, we could design great stuff, but you know, if the client doesn't want to do it, it's not going to happen.
Mm.
So I think changing attitudes have to take place, and I think they're starting to. I mean, as climate change is becoming more and more in the forefront, the Green New Deal, New York State has put in a lot of energy-efficient programs. New York City has as well. I think that attitudes will start to change.
Wayne, I know we're talking about homes, but at the same time, you mentioned New York City, and I was thinking earlier today, okay, how are they going to retrofit or make the apartment buildings and the condos, how are they going to make them more energy efficient? That's a huge job.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the changes will happen in the mechanical systems. There are definitely very efficient mechanical systems nowadays that can be put in. You can take out the old oil-burning furnaces, and you could put in much more efficient natural gas. You might even be able to put in individual units in the apartments or offices that are run on electricity that are super efficient. Retrofitting the envelope of the building, you can change windows. In my passive house, for instance, I use a triple glazed window, which you know, is obviously better than a double and better than a single. So a lot of office buildings and a lot of buildings in New York City still have single-pane windows.
Mm.
So if you were to retrofit it with double-pane or triple-pane, you would not only save energy, but you'd make it super quiet.
All these things that we could do right away. And I just want to mention that if anyone does a quick Google search, they could go on and they could see your home right away.
That's great.
Wayne Turret, architect.
TheRedArch.com.
Wayne Turret, architect, founder of the Turret Collaborative, and he has a passive home. Not passive-aggressive, just a passive home. Wayne, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.
Be well.
Right. Bye.
If you'd like to comment on today's program, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Twitter, you can find us at FullStoryWSHU. And once again, we're pushing the podcast today. Remember, all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the full story. Now we're going to talk about something that most of us have done in our life, and that is to drive a car. Most of us drive cars with internal combustion engines. Pretty simple. You put gas in the tank, you turn the key, the engine goes, the exhaust comes out. That is why so many say we need to switch to electric vehicles, hybrids, solar-powered cars, and so on. Bruce Becker is the president of the Electric Vehicle Club of Connecticut. Hi, Bruce.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Great. I'm actually standing in a 360 State LEED Platinum building. It's powered and heated with a fuel cell, and looking out at the water. I've got an electric car downstairs in the garage.
A fuel cell. You know, we were just talking about that the other week because a data center is being built up in New Britain, which will be powered by fuel cells. And I'd love to do a full program on that sometime in the future. But right now, let me talk for a little bit about electric vehicles. How many EVs are in Connecticut nowadays?
About 10,000. The growth rate year over year is over 40%, but the rate has to be greater to meet the state's climate goals and commitments. the key to all of this, and maybe it's a theme of your show today, is just not burning fossil fuels, whether it's a fuel cell or a building that is all electric with renewable sources. But the most important contributor, the biggest contributor to climate change, and particularly in the Connecticut region, particulate pollution is cars. And it's a huge problem that, according to the American Lung Association, kills 100 people in Connecticut a year because of asthma and respiratory disease. And it creates hundreds of millions of dollars of additional health care costs.
For those who don't know, and I know that if you've gone looking for a car recently, you understand about electric vehicles. But for those who don't know, give us 30 seconds on how they work.
Yeah, they're much simpler than gas-powered cars. They have about a third as many components and basically have a battery and an electric motor. Electric motors are much simpler than motors that are run with gasoline. And there's an increasing number that are available. So you have batteries that, based on the cars that are available today, the one I'm driving, I have a Tesla that'll take me 335 miles on a charge. So I can go pretty much anywhere I'd want to go course of the day and plug in at night. And there's some cars with smaller batteries, like the original Nissan Leaf has a capacity of about 80 miles, but the new versions will bring you over 200 miles. So you have a very simple system that you plug in at night typically and power just with electricity. Very efficiently, and when you break the car, it actually charges the battery too.
I didn't realize the new Tesla can go that far.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation in Connecticut because the dealers have unfortunately blocked Tesla from selling cars in the state. So the several thousand of us who have Teslas in Connecticut have to drive out of state to buy them. But there is a great service facility in Milford. Every year, the batteries get less expensive, and so it's more affordable to have larger batteries. And entire countries have banned the sale of cars that use gasoline, by 2025 and beyond. So it's going to be the trend. If you're not driving an electric car now, odds are you will in 5 to 10 years.
Will they be just straight EV cars or what may be called hybrids, gasoline and electric?
The hybrids really don't, in my mind, don't make as much sense. I mean, they're a good, if you have a small battery, it's a good way to make sure you can get to your destination. But now the charging infrastructure is such that, and there's high-speed charging available. I routinely take my car to Maine or Virginia because if you do go beyond the range of your battery, it's pretty easy to charge. My wife has a car that has an 80-mile range, but that's been fine because her driving is pretty local, and most people don't commute more than about 40 or 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So, the trend is towards all electric cars. There still are some hybrid cars, but a hybrid car has to have both a battery, electric motor, and a gas engine. So you have some of the advantages of an electric car, but some of the disadvantages of having to service an internal combustion engine. Electric cars really require very little service. People have been able to drive for 100,000 miles without any major servicing, which is unheard of for a gas-powered car.
I know I only have you for another 4 minutes or so I'm going to try and sneak in two or three more quick questions. I know we're not putting out exhaust if we have an EV, but the electricity to charge the car still has to come from somewhere, right?
Yeah, in Connecticut, the grid is getting cleaner and cleaner. And the neat thing about a electric car is the longer you own it, the cleaner it gets. And I charge my car with solar panels on my roof, so it's 100% clean. And anyone in Connecticut, whether they're Eversource or United Illuminating customer, they can elect 100% renewable electricity on their bill. So you can, from the get-go, be driving a car that is 100% non-polluting.
You're saying you have solar panels on your house or your garage, and then you just charge your car from that?
Yes. I In fact, I have enough solar panels on my house to power two cars, as well as I have an all-electric house with electric heat pumps. So, I think the challenge for all of us is to find a way not to use fossil fuels either for transportation or for our homes. And it's the technology is here today, and it's actually economical. If you look at the total cost of ownership, electric car, you don't have to buy gasoline, or the maintenance costs are like 10% of what they'd be for a gas car. If you count those in, it's cheaper to own a Tesla than a Honda Accord.
Let me get two more questions to you. What about solar-powered cars?
Well, the way my car is solar-powered, because I power it with the solar energy on my roof, there are some cars that have integrated solar panels, but you actually need, unless you're going to go a very short distance, you need to generate more power than you can get from the roof of your car.
Because I remember seeing some of the, I believe it was students out in California somewhere a year or two ago who have a competition. And so basically, like you're saying, the roof and the windows and so on, they were solar panels.
Oh, in a laboratory, you can do that. But the panels have to be bigger than a normal car would be to generate enough, and particularly if the car is of a normal weight. But if you have a super lightweight car, then you can achieve that on an experimental basis. But the cars are getting more efficient. Maybe there will be a day when you'll be able to do that. But battery storage is usually an essential component. Now, there are also fuel cell cars that basically make electricity from fuel cells. But there's a very small number of those, and the cost and technology for storing energy now with batteries is more economical.
Bruce Becker is the president of the Electric Vehicle Club of Connecticut. And David Michel, fortunately, is still with us. David, as you probably heard earlier in the program, he's a Connecticut state representative from Stamford. Do you own an electric vehicle as an environmentalist?
Not yet, but I definitely have my eyes on the Model 3 from the Tesla. And actually, that would be my favorite electric vehicle for multiple reasons. The seats, there's no more leather in the Tesla cars, so they don't either buy leather from the animal industry. Oh. So I think that's really the complete picture in the Model 3 Tesla or in the Tesla vehicles.
I looked into an electric vehicle a few years back, and I have to admit I was put off by the fact that you could only go a certain distance. And it was in the back of my mind. I said, I don't want to be breaking down by the side of the road. But to hear that it's going over 300 miles nowadays?
Yeah, no, and that's why I'm actually really interested as my next vehicle. And my drive from Stamford to Hartford does require a certain range.
Right. So same thing. What we're going to do now is we're going to bring in Angie Carpenter, who's Islip Town Supervisor. Hi, Angie. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're talking about the environment nowadays and the things that we should be doing and what towns and states should be doing to make changes right away. And reading about what you're doing is pretty amazing, because it seems that you're reconfiguring your downtown for, if you will, the future, and to take in all the different aspects of planning.
Well, we are very quite fortunate, because we had the infrastructure in place, if you will, to maximize the opportunities for transit-oriented development in a number of our downtowns. And I think Bayshore is one of the most successful examples of where that is all happening. The downtown is a short block from the train station, and another block or two to the ferries. So you have ample opportunities to go elsewhere other than in a car from the downtown. So we created a downtown development district, increased density, and putting apartments above stores, above retail, and creating new mixed-use developments with retail on the ground floor and apartments above. And one particular project was just approved that literally is adjacent to the train station, that on the second floor you can walk across a walkway and be on the train platform.
Wow. It's like I'm stepping back in time, going back to when I was a kid, because you're talking about a neighborhood.
Yes, a neighborhood.
That's amazing. People knowing each other, knowing your neighbors, getting out, walking. Before you know it, they'll be sitting on the stoop at night.
And playing stoop ball.
And playing stoop ball and stick ball out in the streets. I mean, that's the way it should be nowadays. You know, Angie, what's interesting is we've been told that millennials really want this more and more. But from my observation, there are boomers who are also giving up their homes, moving out of the country because, look, they don't want to take care of the houses. They don't want to mow the lawn anymore. And they want to move to what you're describing.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, empty nesters, you know, also, too. Kids go off, get married. The grandkids come, and you've got this big old house, like you said, with a lawn to mow and walks to shovel and all of the other things that comes along with home ownership, a roof that now needs to be replaced or, you know, a leaking basement. And as people get older, they're less inclined to be able to do that kind of thing themselves and are looking for that, put the key in the door and walk into your space and, you know, lock it and leave and go off to dinner or, you know, away for a weekend and not have to be concerned about what's happening back at the house.
So what's the biggest roadblock to planning something like this for the future? What are you running up against that drives you crazy?
Well, I think a lot of people are, and I guess it's an education process, understand the benefits of this kind of development. And again, I'll preface it by saying there has to be a balance. You really have to strike a balance. We certainly don't want to recreate, you know, high density, you know, Queens. We want to maintain the character of what so many people came out to Long Island for, but still within the realm of having it be a little bit more practical in the utilization of the space that we have. So if we can create these pockets of houses, housing developments that, you know, utilize green space and have amenities, you know, on the parcel and keeping people, you know, within their neighborhood, if you will, it winds up being a win-win. But again, you've got to have an education process in place and get people to understand what you're trying to achieve and how important it is, too, because, you know, we don't have an infinite amount of resources. Mm. People will all agree that the taxes in our part of the country, whether it is New York or Connecticut, are higher than it is in most other parts of the country. And people do not have an appetite for increasing what they pay in property taxes. They certainly don't want any of their services diminished. If anything, they want more services. So what are you left with? The only way you're going to get around that is to increase, you know, development, increase the amount of assessed, you know, property that you have that will bring in more revenue. We need more revenue-generating properties to try to help strike that balance.
So can I sneak in two more questions before we finish up?
Sure.
If I could ask you about the sewage waste management system, because that's part of what we're talking about nowadays in terms of runoff and affecting the waterways and the and the bays and so on. What are you doing that's different?
Well, I know with this project that we were just successful in getting $10 million from the state of New York for the redevelopment of the downtown of Central Islip. This is the third time that we applied for this grant, and times one and two, we put a focus on sewers, understanding how important it was to have that in place so that we could get the wet uses, we could get the restaurants, the kinds of things that would keep a downtown viable and successful. There didn't seem to be an appetite for funding that. So when we went back the third time, we kind of couched it a little bit differently, but we were adamant that sewer funding had to be a part of it. And we were successful in getting $2 million to put towards the sewers. The project is going to be a lot more expensive than that, obviously, but we are working on identifying other sources of revenue, and the balance would be filled by the users, by user fees. But once we get that, you know, connection working in that downtown, the rest of the uses that will maintain and keep the viability of a successful will come.
Angie, we only have 30 seconds left. Is this the future we're looking at now?
I think it has to be, you know, because if we don't, we're going to be doomed as a region. And there is no better place, as far as I'm concerned, and certainly I'm less than objective, than our area of the country with every amenity that we have at our door, whether it be the magnificent beaches, the ocean, the bays. We have an airport right here in our own town. We've got a very effective rail system. Needs to be a little more effective, but they're working on it. This is a place people want to be, but they have to be able to afford to stay here. And that's what we're working on now. And maximizing our resources to that extent will enable people to grow old gracefully here where they started their families.
Angie Carpenter, the Islip Town Supervisor. Angie, thank you. Always a pleasure. Please come back.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Be well. Angie Carpenter, bye-bye. Bruce Becker was on with us a little bit earlier, the president of the Electric Vehicle Club of Connecticut. Wayne Turrett, architect, founder of the Turrett Collaborative. You can find his passive home online. David Michel, Connecticut State Representative from Stamford. He'll come back with us in the future. And Professor R. Lawrence Swanson, Associate Dean at the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences and Director of Waste Reduction and Management Institute at Stony Brook U. That's it for our show today. Joelle Schrock is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers, Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen was in the studio today. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.